The following program is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and was first broadcast in 1984. The World of Islam, Islam in North America, The Immigrant Experience. The program is introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings.
There are between 2 and 4 million Muslims in North America. Roughly half are Afro-Americans, a small number are white. The remainder are immigrants from Asia, Africa, and the Arab world. For these Muslims, North American society represents a constant challenge to their Islamic values and way of life. But by no means all immigrant Muslims share the same hopes and fears, or feel those pressures equally. The response differs according to the ethnic origin of the Muslim and the degree of his or her individual success within this society. Most Muslims want to preserve their Islamic identity and see it passed on to the next generation. What are their chances of maintaining those values? What compromises must they make with American society, and at what cost? In this program, reported and narrated by Julian Crandall-Hollick, we're going to take a look at the Muslim immigrant experience in North America.
The first Muslim immigrants came with their Christian and Druze cousins from Lebanon and Syria at the turn of the century. Many took up peddling and soon fanned out across the entire continent. They were followed in turn by Turks and other Arabs attracted by the prospect of earning $5 a day in Ford's new automobile plants. They settled in industrial cities such as Dearborn, Toledo, Cedar Rapids, or Chicago. Most of these early Muslim immigrants found it especially difficult to retain their Islamic values. They were usually isolated and under great pressure to conform to the dominant culture of the American melting pot. The first step towards assimilation was often through marriage.
At that time, there weren't many Muslim women in this country, or vice versa, you know, for the women, boys.
Aziz Abraham's father came from Lebanon and was the first Muslim to settle in New England in 1895.
And there was a great interchange, you know, they'd marry outside the religion. And some of the Muslim brides converted to Islam, some of the non-Muslim grooms converted to Islam, and of course a lot were lost to Islam.
And as I grew up, we were raised among all Christian people. I didn't know a thing about Islam.
Ramzi Hassan is the daughter of early Lebanese immigrants.
I didn't know what I was at the time. And I associated with this Christian girls, and the whole neighborhood were all Catholics, went to Catholic church, you know. And I enjoyed being with them and everything. I used to go to confession every Friday with the girls.
Too often it was left to Muslim women, themselves barely literate and ignorant of the outside world, to try to pass on the teachings and values of Islam to the next generation. The more fortunate children were taught the Quran and Arabic by teachers determined to preserve Islamic values in North America.
Who was a granite cutter. He eventually went back to Lebanon and he passed away there. He eventually went blind.
Sam Hassan's grandfather came to the United States from the Lebanese village of Baalbek, but returned after a few years, leaving his sons to make their way in the United States.
But he was a very strict teacher and he didn't charge our parents a nickel. He taught us 7 days a week, 2 hours a day. And every time we graduated, you know, we remembered a chapter, he would have a dinner for us and invite our parents. He bought all the pencils, the paper, the books. In fact, he gutted the whole downstairs of his house and made classrooms out of it.
In the mid-1920s, legislation brought all immigration to an abrupt halt. There were probably no more than a few thousand Muslims here at most, mainly grouped in the industrial centers of Michigan and Illinois, while the rest lived in isolated and self-contained communities scattered across the continent, a relic of the peddling days. The earliest known mosques date from this period: Ross, North Dakota, Highland Park, Michigan, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Most Muslims kept a low profile, eager to get on and to avoid discrimination. They They usually considered themselves Americans first and Muslims a quiet and distant second.
My mother was more Americanized than anything, really. And a real Muslim lady covers her hair and stuff like that. Like when I first got married, my mother-in-law insisted, she insisted that I cover my hair. And I said I was a bride yet still. And I told my husband, never, I'm not gonna cover my hair. I was born in this country, I'm an American.
Muslims only really started to come to this country in significant numbers in the early 1960s. Most came as students, usually in science and technology. Their studies completed, many married and settled here, usually in the larger cities. Turks and Palestinians in New York, Iranians in Houston or Los Angeles, East Africans in Toronto, Arabs and Asians in Detroit, Chicago or Boston. Over half of the nearly 2 million immigrant Muslims are in fact either American or Canadian citizens now. The pre-war immigrants tended to be blue-collar, poorly educated, and not upwardly mobile. The new immigrants, on the other hand, are already middle-class and highly educated. For instance, 2 out of every 5 Pakistanis have PhDs or master's degrees. And they're also mainly professionals, doctors, scientists, college professors, or successful entrepreneurs. The Muslim community counts over 60 different nationalities, of which Pakistanis make up about a tenth, followed by Egyptians, Iranians, and Lebanese. Yet despite this extraordinary variety, they all share commitment to Islam. As the numbers grew, communities formed. The newer, more self-confident immigrants began to organize Sunday school classes in Arabic and the Quran for their children. They raised money to build mosques to cater to the spiritual and social needs of the Muslims, while the older generations began to return to Islam, spurred on by the example of the young. Today, there are over 600 Islamic centers scattered across the country, usually built and paid for from within their communities. They're linked by 2 main organizations, the Muslim World League, with headquarters in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and the Muslim Students Association, based in Indiana. The MSA, set up in 1962, has over 200 chapters and 150,000 members. According to Rabie Ahmed, a Sudanese ex-president of the MSA, the organization was set up to meet a very practical need.
First of all, they asked for some kind of, some kind of forum or an association. They need to relate to each other, you know, when you have Muslims in a campus. They need to relate to each other because they need to pray together. They need to observe certain occasions, religious occasions. And they also need, to live in their culture, to be part, still part of their culture.
First, we want to create a sense of unity among them. We want to bring them together.
Tariq Qureshi from Pakistan has worked with the MSA for over 10 years.
So that this loneliness, this terrible sadness which is setting on their souls, that could be lifted and they could be given some hope that here are people who are also Muslims and they are trying to hold to their values. Second, we want to create an Islamic consciousness in them so that they could have a strong yearning, a desire for living an Islamic life.
While the MSA is autonomous and based in the United States, the Muslim World League, or Rabita, is a Saudi organization designed to promote Islam worldwide. Dawood Assad is Assistant Secretary General of the New York office. A Palestinian who has worked here for 30 years as an engineer, Assad believes the most pressing problem today is the lack of trained imams for the roughly 450 Muslim communities in North America.
Now, unfortunately, these days, you'll find many Islamic centers and organizations in America, they need those imams, but an imam should be trained and he should know about jurisprudence in Islam. He should know all phases of Islam. But unfortunately, we have people who are not trained. They think if they read 1 or 2 surahs of the verse of the Quran or they study, they go to Saudi Arabia for 1 month or 2 months and they study something about Islam, when they come here, they think themselves they are an imams.
Most Islamic centers bring together Sunnis and Shias with no apparent friction. But there also exist substantial Shia communities, mainly Iranians, Asians, and East Africans from Uganda and Tanzania, with their own mosques, leadership, and ultimate allegiance to the Shi'is' spiritual leader, Ayatollah Hui, in Iraq. The Iranian hostage crisis not only split the Shias across national and ethnic lines, it also raised the question of where political loyalties should lie. Abdulaziz Sashadina from Tanzania is one of the leaders of the Shiite community in North America.
I would put it in this way, that it was a question of loyalty being divided. One loyalty was acquired and one loyalty was intrinsic. And that has somehow made it possible for the Shiites to maintain dual loyalty. That as long as Iran is doing something within the Islamic bounds, then our loyalty is also with Iran. But if Iran is going to do something that is not religiously prescribed or proscribed, one would say, then of course the loyalty would shift. And that's why within the community there was a big division. Some supporting the taking of the hostages, some majority did not support the taking of the hostages.
The Iranian Revolution was one of two key world events that gave the new immigrants self-confidence to assert their identities as Muslims. When Salahuddin Malik came to Canada in the early 60s from Pakistan, he tended to suppress his Islamic identity in the interests of getting ahead.
So earlier on, there were inhibitions on us. There were some fears. You come here for your education, and you don't want any obstacle in the achievement of your goal. So you suppress your identity. But now things are very different. 20 years have made a lot of difference, especially after the 1973 Arab-Israeli war. Things have changed tremendously. This is the very fact that the embargo was partially successful, if not fully successful, gave more confidence to the Muslims in North America.
5 years later, another event in the Muslim world gave a further boost to that emerging self-confidence.
The Iranian Revolution served to consolidate, in a large measure, the Sunni community in this country.
Akbar Muhammad is a son of the late Elijah Muhammad and has been a Sunni Muslim since the early 1960s.
I felt proud on some levels, yes. I think Sunnis were surprised that a man such as Ayatollah Khomeini could, in fact, accede to the leadership, political leadership as well as religious leadership of Iran. I think they were very impressed by that.
The Iranian Revolution had repercussions within some of the older Muslim communities in North America, such as that in Dearborn, Michigan.
The older generation was no longer attending that mosque. It had been taken over by newer immigrants who were far more fundamentalist, and they were unhappy about this.
Alexa Naf is an Arab historian who has produced an oral history of early Muslim immigration to this country.
They wanted to have the women veiled and the women segregated and the women do all those sort of thing, and even the men. So the people in Dearborn who had built the old mosque were now moving out of it and not attending it any longer. And there was talk when I was there of building a new mosque, going through the whole process of building a new mosque and just abandoning the old mosque to the newer fundamentalist immigrants that had come in and taken it over. And they were very unhappy about it.
Whatever the impact of events in Iran on the majority of Americans, they had definite beneficial effects on Muslims here. Not only did they become more assertive and confident, for the first time, major Muslim states in the Middle East began to extend financial and moral aid to the young community. Within the minority Shia community, the general effects were also beneficial. Once again, Abdulaziz Sashadina.
For example, the Shiite community always, before the Iranian Revolution, had a complex. And that complex was to be accepted by the Sunnis as proper Muslims. Because the Sunni Muslims will always reject Shiites as not being good Muslims. And after the Iranian Revolution, somehow that confidence was regained, that no, we can claim to be Shiites and still be accepted. And we need not hide our identity as being Shiites.
Just how much pressure are Muslims under in North America to maintain their values and Islamic way of life? One obvious problem in the eyes of most Muslims is the media and its treatment of Islam. Dr. Salwa Malik is a physician from Pakistan. Her teenage daughter Somi was born and raised in this country.
Everything is so totally anti-Islamic that it gets me mad to watch the news.
Yes.
A lot of the times. Because, like, for instance, when the Pope was shot, they said it was a Muslim militant.
Muslim militant, yeah.
Militant, whatever. That's what I mean.
Exactly.
But if it had been a Christian that shot him, they wouldn't have called it a Christian militant or a Jewish militant in that case. And it's just like everything is totally blown out of proportion when it comes to Islam.
Another problem area, according to Turkish architect Bora Pavani, is a perceived anti-Islamic bias built into the educational system.
The biggest problem, I think, that I encounter as a Muslim and a parent, which I think I am, is the fact that the school system obviously does not appreciate any difference in religion in the pupils. And therefore, especially in the first grade, and second grade, and third grade, there's a lot of Christian doctrine built into the system.
And yet Americans do generally show greater tolerance nowadays of other languages and cultures, even if they don't always understand them. For most Muslims, this means public and perhaps private tolerance of their faith. In practical terms, public schools are now generally more understanding of Muslim dietary requirements or the wishes of parents concerning dress codes for their teenage daughters. Muslims, of course, are required to pray 5 times a day.
I travel a lot and I prayed at the airports, prayed on the side of the roads and whatever.
Rafil Dafir is a doctor from Iraq living in New York State.
We even prayed in restaurants when we were traveling, and people just, you know, look at you for a little while and they walk. They don't bother. Occasionally they will stop and ask you what that is without any ridiculing it or without being nasty. 10 years ago, it would have been an entirely different story.
Bora Pavani, on the other hand, has discovered that it's better not to make any public display of being a Muslim.
I have to overlook basically the occasions, praying times, and anything that conflicts with my work. Chances are sometimes it would be omitting perhaps to mention that I'm a Muslim. It can't really be separated sometimes as just being religion. In this area, there are other nationalities that not necessarily look at Turkish population as dear friends.
I've never had any problem in people accepting me because I'm a Muslim.
Dr. Salwa Malik from Pakistan.
I think they respect my values. Like when we socialize with our American friends, initially we used to serve them alcohol, but then we decided that this is not Islamic. Why should we be serving? We don't drink, why should we serve them? Even though most of them have said that they don't enjoy, you know, their meals or going to parties when there's no alcohol. I feel that as a Muslim, I have a right to refuse them drink in my house. And I think they begin to accept it. And so when they come here, they don't expect to be served any alcohol.
Heavy pressure on Muslims comes in the area of private morality and family life. In the more traditional Muslim communities, the liberation of women from the home, for example, has often had a disruptive effect on the stability of marriages.
It has somehow created many, many family problems. And we hear of many cases of separation of men and women who are Muslims, who have come to this country and have not been able to adjust psychologically, so obviously it has created a very tense situation in the family relationship between husband and wife. So we have that, it's a very acute problem.
Another area of concern for some Muslims, especially those from Pakistan, is the near impossibility of living in an extended family system, although this notion is perhaps more traditional than specifically Islamic. Sexual permissiveness and the free and chaperoned mixing of boys and girls, on the other hand, is often deeply disturbing to all Muslim parents, such as Alaa al-Din Saeed, an Egyptian education consultant.
I think the teenage period is one of the most disturbing to the parents. It's not only for a Muslim family, but probably for a non-Muslim family too. And the parents of a teenage Muslim girl have to spend quite some time to convince the young lady that there are some limits to the freedom of the girl, and there are things that are acceptable and not acceptable in our Islamic tradition.
For many of the younger, more radically orthodox Muslims, there's also a fundamental contradiction between living in a society based on credit and interest and Islamic ideas of economics.
We want to help the Muslims as such. We don't want them to go to these financial institutions, borrow money on interest, because this is something repugnant to our faith.
The solution advanced by the MSA's Tariq Qureshi is nothing less than the creation of an Islamic economic system within the American and Canadian economies. The method adopted so far with some limited success is to ask Muslims to deposit their savings with a Muslim cooperative project rather than in US or Canadian banks.
Recently, it has been giving money for purchase of automobiles to sick people to pay their bills. We also try to help people who had spending habits, like they buy things on credit cards. And we took their paychecks and then budgeted their income and their expenses. And we took many people out of these credit cards purchases.
How will the next generation of Muslims be able to retain their Islamic values and identity?
I have two of my kids in school here, and for 3 years I come every Sunday.
For Shakir Saganjuri, an Albanian auto body worker, the mosque and the Islamic Sunday school are the only really effective measures.
The reason I'm here every Sunday, and the reason I'm here for 3 years as my daughter, because neighborhood where I live, we don't have a Muslim at all. In school she goes, I probably tell kids I'm a Muslim, probably kids say, what's that? You know, and the reason I'm here, I wear a little bit, yes, that's true.
Others fear that the struggle to preserve Islam's values against these pressures will prove too much for their children.
There are many pressures, and I see the pressure on two levels. One is to become American or Canadian as soon as possible. And that means adopting the ways or adopting the manifest culture that is found in the societies. And that has been one of the very difficult areas, because how do you then reconcile some of the basic teachings of Islam with the norms that are found in the society?
And before you know it, you are finished. You come like a strong rock, and by the time after your 10 or 15 years, you feel as if only the pebble has been left in you. The large rock has been eroded by the other influences.
On the other hand, Abdul Hamid, a landscape gardener from Malaysia and married to an American convert, is optimistic about raising a Muslim family here.
Once the children is at home, that it's up to the parent to reinforce and stimulate the children into a certain kind of direction that the parent want. And it's proof that I've been successful. Like some of the Muslims that I met in the US who have children does bring up their children into a Muslim environment, and it's been very successful. And I'm very optimistic about bringing up children as a Muslim in the US.
The reactions of Muslims to life in North America are probably as varied as their national origins. The Ismaili Shias from East Africa, India and Iran came to Canada in the early 1970s.
There has been no difficulties in adopting to this life. Prophet himself was a businessman, had ongoing businesses, had all the commitments of the world, and yet he could maintain his principles, and so with us. So it hasn't been a struggle at all.
Shiraz Ismail is a leader of the Shia Imami Ismailis based in Toronto.
We believe that a true Muslim has to excel in whatever he is doing. Then he's a true Muslim. He should not forsake the worldly things. So if you are a very good businessman, then you are a true Muslim. If you're a good teacher, you're a true Muslim. You should not forsake that and just go and be a missionary or something like that, for example. That wouldn't be a true Muslim because you are forsaking your responsibilities. So in that context, it hasn't been a problem for us at all, because you have to excel in whatever you do to be a true Muslim.
Muslims will probably only begin to be recognized once they're organized and politically important as a constituency at local and state levels. On an individual level, they'll probably continue to move towards some form of accommodation with North American society.
Some kind of an accommodation is necessary, given the fact that it does not actually alter your beliefs or your values or whatever.
For Layaldin Said, Islam is sufficiently flexible to allow him to live in peace in the United States.
Islam permits you to accommodate. It will say, do the best you can to apply Islamic tradition or Islamic instruction. However, God will forgive you if you don't, if this is the only way that you can survive in a society.
Well, our dream is that we want to make our presence felt in this part of the world. And we want to see Islam flourish over here. Because if we believe that Islam is something good for us, it would be the height of selfishness on our part not to share it with others.
The Immigrant Experience was written and produced by Julian Crandall Hollick. The program was introduced by ABC's Peter Jennings. The technical producer was Peter K. Storkerson, and the rebroadcast producer was Dean Capello. The music consultant was Brian Silver of International Music Associates. Consultant to this program was Dr. Arif Gayur of St. Lawrence University. The World of Islam is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, in cooperation with WBUR Boston, and is made possible with a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm Mark Schilling. If you'd like to comment on this program or to order cassette copies and transcripts, please phone area code 508-486-9180 or fax number 508-486-9652 during regular business hours. This is NPR, National Public Radio.